I think, like, realistically, to some degree, when you have those kind of things happening, and especially, like, I've just had so many injuries stacked up over the years that at some point it does feel like, is this ever going to stop? Like, is luck ever going to go my way? And I think, you know, when I lend some perspective to that, I have been very lucky. But the mindset that I kind of take to all of that is really two things. I think that approaching it with a positive mindset, by that I don't necessarily mean that you have to wake up smiling every day. Oftentimes in our society, positivity is kind of seen as like always smiling and always happy. But positivity can be just as simple as telling yourself it's all going to work out in the end.
Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it.
Hey, Emily, welcome back to the Stokecast.
Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
I'm good. I don't know.
I can't do it.
I don't know why I decided to start that one with an Aussie accent or a attempt at one. But
yeah, that definitely wasn't an Aussie accent for either of us. We failed miserably.
Come on, it wasn't terrible.
That's British. That's not even Australian.
What are you talking about? I wasn't even trying to do an accent right there.
Oh, you just sounded... that's terrible.
This is ridiculous. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 50. Episode 50 of the Stokecast.
Boo, 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 boo. Boo, boo, boo. What do we have on today? We have Drew Peterson. He's a skier, and he also calls himself a mountain human, but I call him one of the most fun guests we've ever had. I'll say it. I don't care. He was so fun to talk to. He's so down to earth, and we had, just a great chat about life and about risk and about, obviously, the mountains and injuries, and it was a really well-rounded conversation, and I really loved the talk with him.
Totally. So yeah, other than us losing our minds a little bit here on episode 50, I guess that does go in nicely to this episode, because we were a bit silly in this episode. And this is probably, as Emily said, one of the most fun. We were just cracking up with Drew the whole time. Like, you'll see a different side of us on this one, I think, where we really leaned into just kind of silliness and sarcasm, and it's great. But there's a lot of substance to this conversation. You're going to get a lot out of it, but you're also going to just be smiling the whole time. I think the laughter and the smiles come through the speakers.
Absolutely. So please enjoy our conversation with Drew Peterson.
Dropping in now with Drew Peterson. What's going on, Drew?
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Of course. How you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. It is a beautiful spring day here in Salt Lake City, Utah, where I now call home. And I'm sitting in my backyard drinking a glass of water, wearing slippers. And life is good.
Man, that sounds amazing.
It doesn't sound bad. Yeah. Where did you used to call home?
I grew up in Colorado. I grew up in Silverthorne, so right next to a bunch of ski areas, A-Basin, Copper, Keystone, Breckenridge. I grew up right there with pretty much the National Forest as my backyard, so I was very fortunate to grow up there. And then I moved out here to Salt Lake City about 6 years ago, and this has been home ever since.
And was the move just because of going to different mountains?
The biggest motivation was definitely the mountains out here. The Wasatch Mountains are just incredible, especially if you're being such a small mountain range. They are very impressive, with a lot of fun activities to do in them. Second reason was the snow. The rumors are true. The snow out here in Utah really is that good. And it's far more consistent than Colorado. And I guess the third reason is to go to school. So I went to the University of Utah.
All right, number three still squeaking in there. School,
yeah.
No,
you're damn right about the Wasatch, though. Absolutely beautiful, incredibly epic mountain range. I have been out twice trying to hit Mount Superior. One in the once in the summer and once in the winter, and my winter skin up was stopped due to some pretty bulletproof ice, and the summer was stopped due to people with me not wanting to climb that upper ridgeline, getting a little scared. So Mount Superior eludes me.
Ah, bummer. We'll come on out and we'll go up there. Either skis or running shoes or something on our feet.
I'm game. That sounds like a plan. So what? Go for it. Jinx, go.
You'd think we'd figure this out by now. But so you grew up in Colorado, went to school in Utah. So normally when we have these interviews, I mean, some of the people that we interview, right, they didn't grow up in these beautiful places. They grew up in the Midwest or the Northeast like us, and then they find the big mountains. So you seem to have that kind of nurture in your whole life. So was there ever a point where you're like, no, I'm not going to do anything in the outdoors. I'm going to go on a different path. Was there anything like that that you were thinking of outside of the outdoor world?
No, I definitely don't think that there was ever a point where I was like, I'm going to walk away from this, going to walk away from the mountains. You know, I definitely thought about taking a more traditional route and really committing to academics and chasing a professional career in some other context. But no, I definitely have had a lifelong connection to the outdoors and to the mountains. There was one summer when I lived in California, which was awesome. I lived at the beach and I surfed like before and after work every day. But after 3 months of that, I was like, okay, I'm glad this was a summer internship. Like, I need the mountains. The mountains are definitely my life force.
I love that.
So at what age did you start really pursuing the professional career? I guess more than just wanting to be in the mountains, but like starting to think that this is what you wanted to do and build those relationships to like be an ambassador or be an athlete and start down that path.
Yeah, totally. I guess like a little bit of a backstory, like just to see like how I got to that point. Like I started skiing when I was two, and then like I kind of mentioned, the National Forest was pretty much my backyard growing up. And I always say I'm crazy spoiled, and I am, but I'm very appreciative for how spoiled I was to grow up right there. I'm very grateful for that. And my parents made a lot of sacrifices to make that possible. So that was huge. And I think like that's where kind of like the root of all it starts is growing up right there. And I figured you guys would kind of dig this story. So I probably don't remember it. I was probably too young, like at least like a primary memory. So this is coming from the way my mom tells me is that as soon as my brother and I were old enough and big enough to go into the woods and bring our dog with us, we were allowed to go whenever we wanted. We just had to bring the dog. So that was kind of, it's been a lifelong passion and home for me. And by home, I don't mean Colorado or Utah, just home being outdoors in the woods or in the mountains. And as far as like, you know, kind of fast track, getting to your question after a 5 minute circumlocution,
dude, it was a good departure. I mean, it's funny you were like talking about the dog rule. As soon as my dogs started barking downstairs and Emily just had to close the door in the background.
No way. But man, that's perfect.
Yeah, spot on, right on cue.
Yeah.
Nice. But yeah, and then I grew up with a pair of skis on my feet, and you know, I'd love to talk more about that because I got to give all the credit to my dad. He's still the most passionate skier I know in this entire world. I'm very thankful that he got me on a pair of skis when he did. But yeah, kind of fast tracking to when I started pursuing this professionally. It was probably like right before my 16th birthday when I got my first ski sponsor. So I've been doing it for a little while. And it kind of all grew from there, you know. When I was 16, kind of just chasing sponsors to make it all a little more possible. And then that was, sorry, I'm doing the math in my head, which should be simple, but in fact, in my birthday. So I guess that was like 9 years ago, because I'm 24, be 25 this summer. So yeah, I guess in that 9 years, a lot's changed. But for the past 5 years, I've definitely been very committed and motivated to pursuing this as a professional career, just because I figured out that was the route I wanted to take to make sure I had a lot of time on skis and a lot of time in the mountains.
Well, that is fortunate to have grown up with that environment, and your parents, of course, fostering that love. And so you said you're turning 25, which is interesting because I found your athlete page on the Salomon website, and they had you listed at 0 years old. And I was going to compliment you on the best infant beard I have ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It took me all 0 years of my life to grow this beard. No, but that's super funny. On the Salomon website, we all that's the one piece that kind of got lost in the web development. So everybody's got their age wrong on there. So we're all joking, and I think Mike Douglas is 18 years old or something on there, and I don't know how old Douglas is, but he's not 18.
Definitely not 0 years old. I love it.
Well, dude, you've accomplished a lot in your less than 1 year.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. And I guess the reason the Salomon website says I'm 0 years old is because I am the baby on the team.
Oh, that makes sense, too. I thought maybe it was an ode to you're young. Yeah, you're 0 years old.
Yeah, I'm the youngest and the newest on that team. But it's really great because they don't all the guys on the team don't know me well enough to give me too much flack. So Stan Ray, shout out Stan, still catches all the flack from everyone on the Salomon team because they haven't gotten comfortable with me enough.
Nice. So so now you just have to wait till that happens, and then you're in for reals. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Salomon's got to be a pretty great company to ride with. I just this year got the S-Lab mountain boot and the shift binding, and that was my first foray into Salomon ski gear, and it's been fantastic.
That's awesome, man. Stoked to hear you're on it. That's actually what I ski all the time. I really love being at Salomon, and I guess that kind of goes across the board. I really love what I ski on, which... I'm very happy to be able to say that fully honestly, because I think, just a candid moment, you see a lot of athletes and ambassadors, and I think it's probably natural for consumers to always wonder, do you actually like what you ski on? And I love what I ski on. So I'm proud to say that. And Salomon's a great company. They're super supportive.
Right. Across the board with endorsements, I think it's do you really use that face wash? You use that deodorant? All right. Let's wind it back here. So yeah. we've got you on sticks since you were, learning to walk, and then you grow up and you get your, you're 16 and you get your first sponsor. Now at that point of your skiing career, are you like most 16-year-olds, just in the park kind of Grom, Ripper on the jumps? Or did you see early on more of the passion for the real, mountaineering pursuits and more of the stuff that we see in some of your later projects?
Well, I guess first off, I really like how you phrase that question, because growing up in Summit County, Colorado, it is the park skiing mecca kind of the world. Breckenridge and Keystone right there have phenomenal terrain parks. And to be honest, I am not a park guy in the slightest. I don't remember the last time that I hit a rail or a park jump, and both kind of terrify me. I'm sure that I could still ski through a park. I actually had a decent rail game for never really skiing park. But my passion totally grew from the skiing itself and linking turns, and then that grew into skiing in the backcountry. So when I was younger, I kind of grew up just chasing around my dad and my older brother. And that's how I developed my passion for, just skiing steep, fun terrain. And then I started skiing in the backcountry when I was 14. And so I guess that's kind of how I ended up where I am now. But when I was 16, I guess I would call myself I really hate the term, but a big mountain skier, because it was all the free ride competitions. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that I hate the term is just I feel like that term's kind of overused, because I think of big mountain skiing as big faces in Alaska or something. But
right.
Really, I was just jumping off cliffs to hard pack.
Well, I agree with you. I think that I don't mind launching a 30-foot cliff, but launching a 30-foot booter, is like horrifying.
Okay, for people who are not skiers, can you define these terms? Because you're like you're like hucking. Okay, no, you know that's a thing that people hucking? Might not know.
Hucking is like.
Why don't you let our guests define it? Yeah, okay, right, what's hucking?
True. Whew. Okay, well, hucking, like, I guess we'll get a couple definitions here. Hucking is, like, what I would define as pure airtime. Like, hucking, I would classify as a really big air that there's a very slim chance you're actually going to, like, properly land on your feet. Like, jumping a cliff, somewhere less than that where you are actually going to land on your feet. And then as far as, like, what you're talking about, Jonathan, with, like, hitting a booter, that's when we're talking about, like, a jump in the terrain park. And that was groomed and manicured by a snow cat, which sounds really nice because, like, the angles match up and that's where a bunch of people learn and do a bunch of really cool tricks. But it's kind of terrifying if you're not a park skier because the snow is really hard.
Okay. Let's see. Now I feel like we're all up to speed and we're here. Okay.
There we go. Same page.
How was your ski season, Emily?
Oh, please stop. Yeah. I'm doing sprints. I'm not skiing. I really didn't do that well, but I could do well later this year, Jonathan. So stop. Okay. So back to how did this conversation start with the sponsor when you're 16 years old? Like, you're still a minor also. So I imagine there's additional things to think about for your parents' sake and et cetera. Like, other people we've talked to, I don't think they were sponsored until they were of, like, a legal age from what I can remember of our guests. But so what was that like, and how did they really discover you? Was it the free riding? What was the discovery point?
What was your experience with child labor?
Yeah.
Yikes. Well, it's not even technically child labor because it was an 16. Independent contractor.
Yeah, true. No, we're all good. I'm joking.
No, but that is funny the way you word it, because my parents totally did have to, like, sign athlete contracts, like, for legal purposes before I was 18. But, okay, real question, how it started when I was 16. I guess that winter when I was, like, 15, I went to my first, like, big mountain free ride competitions. I went to the U.S. Extremes in Crested Butte, Colorado. It's one of the, like, most classic big mountain comps where a bunch of guys cut their teeth kind of in – like the prior era of free skiing, you know, like the Shane McConkeys and Seth Morrisons of the world. And when I went there, I had a ton of fun, and I, like, totally didn't expect anything out of it, because, like, some of the kids that are in there, which is funny because it's all people under 18, but some of the kids in there, like, the kids that you see in Powder Magazine. And I was like, there's no way that I can compete with you. And I remember, like, running up to the side to, like, watch Johnny Collins drop in. But then I ended up doing well. I got second there, and then I got I went to another competition in Taos, and I won that one a couple weeks later. And I was like, oh, whoa. I guess, like, skiing with my dad and my brother growing up, like, kind of paid off. So there's the short but sweet version of it. And then, yeah, just started I knew that I wanted to keep pursuing it. So I started reaching out to companies, mostly because I wanted to have good ski on. And it kind of all took off from there. And it was cool at that point in time, because it was kind of a mix of, like, companies reaching out to me and then me reaching out to companies, which in hindsight, I wish I could have seen, like, what my 16-year-old self was doing, like, mailing off, like, my, like, cover letter. Because there were a couple when it was still, like, you would mail it into the team manager rather than email. Mm-hmm. It's cool to look back on, and a couple companies reached out to me, and then over time it's been a really really fun experience, obviously for the skiing, but also for building a career. It's kind of just all stemmed from there, but kind of stayed on the same path.
So you, through the years of, you know, being a sponsored athlete, of course, you need to have a hand in and an eye on the things you can do to extend your exposure and keep nurturing these relationships with the brands. And, you know, from a media mix standpoint, it's like, what films or vlogs or whatever can I put out? What, you know, potentially podcasts like the Stokecast can you get on? You know, what photos in magazines or writing? And I know that you've actually authored, like, 30 something posts on Powder Magazine. So, like, what kind of thought did you put into that just personal brand development from a multitude of mediums?
Ah, that's a good question. I think especially because I've been doing this for a little while, it's been cool to kind of see the media landscape change and just learn from everyone along the way. You know, back when I started, I had my own little blog going, and that was kind of before social media was kind of the ticket. So like I started my own blog, and what people cared about at that point in time was competitions. And now that a lot of stuff has kind of transitioned away from that competition world, it was like, oh, well, you know, can I go shoot photos with this photographer? Maybe that photo lands in a magazine or something. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, I'm also a writer, and my writing's been kind of a fun way to balance in with the skiing, and kind of just see it as, I don't know, it lends perspective to be able to tell stories about everything. And of course, too, that helps on the ski side of things, like with the athlete stuff.
And then so when you're sponsored when you're 16, and then 2 years later you're deciding to go to school and you went to University of Utah. And so what was the thinking in that? I mean, you're already sponsored. You're kind of going down this pro athlete, pro skier path. Were you going to school to, you know, get, you know, a certain level of knowledge? And like, what was the reasoning for going to school, I guess, is my question.
I mean, to be like, you know, just to be candid, like I definitely wasn't making the big bucks. So there's by no means any guarantee of like making a professional career out of all of it. I think the biggest reason that I went to school was I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And like my mindset when I was, you know, 18 was, this is something that's going to be productive for right now and for the future, in that I'm not sure exactly what path I want to go on. And then, you know, I was good. I was kind of the classic college student where after a year or so of that, I realized kind of the track that I did want to go on. So I'm glad that I went to school. It lent me a lot of experience. It helped me grow as a person. And I think on the ski side of things too, it's I don't know. I don't know if I really like the term, but it's good to have a backup plan. And especially to have that backup plan already, like at a young age, because I've certainly experienced over my life and over my ski career, it can all change in an instant, and all this could just disappear, and I have to get a desk job tomorrow. And I really hope that day never comes, but it's nice to know that I'm capable of it if I need to.
Now, what you said that you've experienced enough to know that. What have you experienced to give you that perspective that it could all change? It's a lot of skiers, you know, whether they're 15 or 25, like still young and optimistic about like everything ahead, as you should be. But like, what have you experienced to kind of level that playing field?
I've had quite a few injuries over the years, and It is kind of funny, being as young as I am. I should have like this jovial outlook on things, but it hasn't been a smooth ride by any means. And I wouldn't change that for the world. I've had 9 surgeries in the past 6 years, I think. I've, you know, my helmet has saved my life twice, and those are all really big, scary things that, I think when I was, you know, 16, 18, when I was starting all this, I didn't really realize the weight of all that stuff. But that's what I mean by things can change in an instant. And I'm very grateful that I do have my health. But that's exactly what I mean. Big injuries and big accidents.
So what is the mindset from all those surgeries and from all those injuries that you've learned along the way to kind of pull you through them and get you to the other side, so that you're not kind of just going down a rabbit hole of, you know, feeling sorry for yourself or getting depressed about it or what have you?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a good kind of broad question. It's tough because I think like realistically to some degree, when you have those kind of things happening, and especially like I've just had so many injuries stacked up over the years that At some point, it does feel like, is this ever going to stop? Like, is luck ever going to go my way? And I think, you know, when I lend some perspective to that, I have been very lucky. I have gotten lucky a number of times, and just because there's been some bad luck mixed in doesn't mean anything about it. But the mindset that I kind of take to all of that is really two things. I think that approaching it with a positive mindset, and in by that I don't necessarily mean that you have to wake up smiling every day. I think oftentimes in our society, or especially in this kind of like outdoor adventure sphere, or in the ski world, positivity is kind of seen as like always smiling and always happy. But I learned a really big lesson in after going through some surgeries last year, that positivity doesn't have to mean that you wake up in the morning smiling ear to ear. Positivity can be just as simple as telling yourself it's all going to work out in the end. And you don't always have to know what that means. You don't always have to know when the end is. But I think having that positive mindset that it will all work out in the end is what got me through all of that. And then also I think the other side of it is just trying to gain some perspective from all those injuries. So like for instance, when I was 19, I had this crash where I dislocated my hip, I dislocated my shoulder, partially tore my ACL, broke a few ribs, and I broke my sacrum. And like that kind of like laundry list of injuries just from one crash, is quite literally like what you'd see from a head-on car crash. And after that, I ended up rehabbing for basically like 18 months. And through that entire time, I think what did me well then and what still does me well now if I have to deal with an injury or something is just trying to gain perspective, trying to look at, you know, what can I learn from this and how can I be a more complete human being? Because also in this ski world, it's really simple to be single-minded and it's really simple to just look at what am I going to ski next or, you know, when's the next time I'm skiing deep powder. But learning that there's a lot more to life and to being happy and growing as a person is far more important. And I think injuries have really offered a great opportunity for me to learn some of those lessons.
I think there's nothing to back this statement, but just like listening to what you're saying and thinking about it personally, I feel like there has to be some sort of positive correlation to like the earlier you get hurt in the mountains, the longer you live, because you learn what they can really do, and you like if you go for so long pursuing extreme outdoor sports without having that kind of humbling experience of having an injury or an accident or a close call, then you develop a bit of invincible confidence that is like, you know, fatally dangerous.
I couldn't agree more, and I really like how you put that. I think it's you know, it sucks to learn it through the version of an accident or an injury, but ultimately you need a dose of humility. And I really like what you say, that if you've had it younger, hopefully you live longer. And, you know, if I've learned anything through all of it, whether it be injuries or accidents, is this is all really fun. And I love being in the mountains. I love running around up there and I love skiing really fun stuff, but none of it's worth dying for. And at the end of the day, I want to grow old and I want to have kids and grandkids and I want to teach them how to ski. And I'm really glad that I learned that and I realized it as young as I have. I'm very grateful for that. And I think, you know, it's awesome when people get to learn that lesson without a dose of humility being thrown at them. And I'm all for that too. But yeah, I guess here's to living long, happy lives, and hopefully it means a lot of time in the mountains with it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, to that point of self-preservation and you know, learning through those lessons or those setbacks, I watched Ski the Wild West, which was really well done. Nice work on that. And we can talk more about that project. But to this context specifically, it really resonated when you were up on Mount Rainier and had to call it, had to turn around. And, you know, it was a brief moment in the story, but I'd love to have you expand on that. I've been there twice or three times, but two times to splitboard, and both times had that same experience having to turn around. And I would love to hear the longer version of your experience there.
Sure. Well, first off, thanks for watching the film. And yeah, to any of the viewers out there who watched Ski the Wild West, what Jonathan's referencing is this film that I created where it chronicles my road trip to ski the highest peak in every state of the American West. And of course, the highest peak in the state of Washington is Mount Rainier. And so when we're climbing Mount Rainier to ski down it, we ultimately end up having to turn around shy of the summit. And I think that experience on Mount Rainier and being able to capture that in the film was a great thing, because I think it was just kind of the kind of like anecdote of having to turn around in the mountains other times. There's a lot of times where you'll be going up something and something doesn't feel right, or you're seeing a red flag from the snow, or from the terrain or from the weather. And on Rainier, we were going up, ironically, we were going up the Success Couloir. And we were at, I think, I forget what I say in the film, we're probably at like 13,900 feet or so, right below this like little kind of like headwall at the entrance of the couloir. It was getting a little bit too late in the day. I think it was probably like 10:30 a.m. or so. But it's south facing. So, this was on, I guess we'll probably get to it, but I know it was on May 9th of that year of 2017. So of course in May, there's a lot of powerful sun, and it was just warming up too fast. And there's these big, rime covered rocks and cliffs at the top of Rainier and on the top of a lot of volcanoes. And that was probably our biggest fear, was that rime heating up and the rime falling off or a rock falling off with it. And at that point too, we were above, pretty serious exposure. Like if you just fell straight fall line from where we were, it was not a pretty place where your body would come to a rest. And so it made the decision really easy that day just to, call it early. And we also had a pretty big group and we were moving pretty slow. So it just made sense to call it and ski from there. And fortunately, you know, if you're making those decisions to turn around in the mountains, and you're turning around shy of the summit, fortunately, like for me personally, like I'm a skier first. Definitely call my skier before I call myself a mountaineer. So, the biggest reason I was there was the ski descent, and fortunately, we still skied close to 10,000 vertical feet of really fun corn skiing. It was awesome.
Yeah, the ski descent, even from Camp Muir, is like, it's just magic.
There's something, it goes on forever.
Yeah, it really does. It just never stops. There's something incredible about that mountain.
Yeah, so cool.
So yeah, I had a similar experience on splitboards. Just it was May of 2017, going up there and starting to climb and kind of just feeling, I was halfway up the Ingram direct route on the glacier and leading the team, and knew that like we could have climbed it, but the descent would have been too dangerous because it was like this, like, you know, maybe a half an inch of just crusty ice on top of like 6 inches of faceted sugar snow. So I knew that like we could get up the crustiness, but then as soon as the sun hit and that ice melted, then the rest of it would just like, we'd be falling into crevasses for sure.
Yeah. And I think when you have that level of experience where you know that that's the reality you're facing, it makes it really easy to make the decision. So I guess that's kind of the silver lining is how easy those decisions are to make once you kind of realize and learn the weight of them.
Yeah, and I think you said it in the film, but it was something like turning back is always the right decision. And I like that. That resonated with me, because if you have that gut feeling, then you definitely should not pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, I think I like that you grabbed that out of there. I think the way I normally word it, I don't know how I said it in the film, is the decision to not go is never wrong.
That's it. You nailed it. See, should have left it to you.
it's very cliche, but I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, like I was speaking to earlier, this stuff is incredibly fun. I think that skiing is the greatest thing in the world. It brings me the most joy I could ever imagine, but it's never worth dying for. So it is that simple.
Yeah. The only instance in which to not go is always the right decision is like just in general to work out. Don't use that as an excuse.
Yeah, to go to the gym or to ask the pretty girl for her phone number, or, you know, number yeah. of things.
Yeah. Don't use Drew's advice on that one.
Yeah, don't use that one as a cop out. Come on.
So around this like decision of what pursuits are, you know, within reason, what risks are reasonable to take, where did you start to find your risk threshold? Where did you start to develop that in the sense that, you know, it's not – there are a lot of really great skiers out there, but not every skier would want to drop into, like, the 50-degree head wall above Devil's Kitchen on Mount Hood and, like, know that the consequence is tumbling into those fumaroles and that's not a good thing at all.
Like, fumaroles.
It's a place in the volcano where there's a sulfur gas emitting from. It's Got just it. All rock and sulfur.
Okay.
And Everyone's that's at the bottom of this big headwall on Mount Hood that goes off the summit ridge. So, but I guess what I'm saying is like, where do you develop and define your risk threshold when you say, you know, it's not worth dying for, but yet there are certain situations that like one wrong edge, even if you read the snowpack right, one wrong edge is a goner.
Yeah. I think that's what we're kind of all constantly figuring out for ourselves. I think I'm still figuring out my risk threshold, and it's definitely different on any given day. I think like kind of like what you mentioned with it, like if you're skiing above exposure or something, I think I'm thankful that I have a level of experience where I've had to like learn my risk threshold in terms of skiing ability or what goes wrong if I screw up something on skis. I think the much scarier version is the mountain, and it's impossible to know what the mountain's going to do, whether it be an avalanche or a number of other ways that things could go wrong. And I think that's kind of the risk threshold that I'll constantly be figuring out the rest of my life. I think that's what we're all doing.
I think that's smart too. And it's probably good advice because I don't go to these big mountains. So this is an assumption. I assume though, you don't want to get very comfortable in any sort of level of risk. Like you'd always want to feel a little like, right, you don't want to just say, I have this, I know exactly like what risks I'm willing to take and what I'm not. It has to be like conditional, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important to feel confident. And I think it's really important to feel confident in your abilities, number one. Your decision-making is, of course, a lot more difficult to be confident with. But I think yes, it always demands a certain level of respect. I think that's kind of like similar to the point that you were getting to in the question.
So beyond the you know, amazing climbs and ski descents on that trip, the other element of it was just the journey and like, you know, driving your truck and around the West and like what did that mean to you?
Oh man, I love the open road. And I love just being in the middle of nowhere with a straight highway in front of me. I think that's like, it's kind of in the same spirit of skiing or running or whatever you're doing in the mountains. It's a sense of freedom. And when I first set out on that trip to ski the highest peak in every state of the American West, a huge part of the motivation was just to see more of the West. And the way that I looked at that wasn't just the mountains that I was going to, it was everything that I was going to get to see along the way. So for instance, like on that trip, probably one of the coolest moments was after being at 14,000 feet on top of Mount Whitney, the highest point in the contiguous U.S., we watched the sunrise us from probably about 14,000 feet that day. And then later that day, we watched the sunset from below sea level while we were sipping cervezas on the sand dunes in Death Valley. And I think that was kind of what was so unique and such a great experience about that trip was getting to see all of the in-between and appreciate everything that I hadn't seen in the American West and that I had seen before too.
I'm a sucker for alliteration, and I couldn't help but notice sipping cervezas and sand dunes.
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a good one.
Yeah.
Way to go, man.
Nailed it. Great.
I didn't even catch that. I like it.
I dig it. Well, so beyond cervezas, I also noticed that the only food you ever post on your Instagram is a burrito.
When did you fall in love with burritos?
Been in love with burritos since the day I was born.
So, 0 years old.
Sometimes you're just born with a passion.
So, like, describe what it was like to follow your passion of eating burritos.
I am a lifelong passionate lover of burritos. I have to be honest. Well, like, let's just think practically. First off, a burrito is the perfect way to carry all the nutrients you need.
Yep. Okay.
And it's delicious. First off.
Yeah, and
it's usually
delicious.
Really spicy. Like, what's not to love? And then the real reason that I'm in love with burritos is because they're the perfect food to carry to the top of a mountain and eat on the summit. That's the true passion right there, summit burritos.
Okay, you're convincing me to also, I like burritos, but maybe I could also fall in love with them. Who knows? I'm open-minded.
As long as you keep an open mind, yeah.
Yeah, may I have an open relationship with Andrew, but only for burritos. It'll be good. It'll be really good.
Well, that was a wonderful tangent.
Yeah, so everyone's really excited.
Everyone's really excited about our burrito culture.
My part.
But like, to the people who are like wondering what we're talking about, you gotta go look at my Instagram and see that, like, that's literally like what I eat all the time, and it is the best adventure food out there.
Yeah, no. So prior to our chat, fun fact: I just dropped the 1,000th like on your J-Hole Cody Bowl burrito shot.
Mm. Nice.
Awesome.
So there you go.
I love it.
Have you dropped in Cody Bowl? It's so epic.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I love skiing up in Jackson Hole. I've only skied off Cody Peak a couple times, but wow, what a magnificent mountain, especially right there beside the resort. It's like, I think it's just like the kind of mountain that you would totally draw if you were a five-year-old with one crayon and you were told to draw a mountain.
That's perfect.
Yeah, great imagery. I love that.
Yeah, he's a writer. He knows how to put these things together, yeah.
So what's on your personal and professional horizon?
Ooh, personal and professional horizons. So I have a bit of a hiccup right now. This actually just happened like this week. I tweaked my hip about a month ago, and it was just like this slight discomfort, but I figured I'd get it checked out and just kind of figured this stuff out this week. I've got some inflamed torn cartilage in there right now, so I'm not skiing at the moment, and I'm having to take some time to rest and work out in the gym. But it's kind of like what I was talking about before, because this one's pretty fresh and I like literally just got this news. It's like kind of tough to see the silver lining right now, but it's definitely all going to work out in the end. So my plans are on hold this spring. I had to nix a couple of the plans, which is unfortunate because spring is kind of the best time for skiing, in my opinion. That's when you get to go climb up high mountains and ski down big faces, because the avalanche danger is usually a little bit lower in the spring. So right now, that's my most important horizon, is getting this feeling better. So just really listening to the doctor and really committing to that. And then hopefully once this starts feeling better, I'll still get to ski some fun stuff this spring, still eat some burritos on summits. I mean that in a very professional and personal context. And then, yeah, this summer, I love summer in the mountains, almost as much as winter. It's like kind of hard to say that because I love skiing so much. But running is my summer passion. So I'm kind of transitioning into the running mindset, and, you know, hopefully this little hiccup with my hip, doesn't impede running too much. And if it does, I'll figure that out later. My biggest goal this year on the running side of things is to run my first 100 miler. So starting training for that. And, that's a huge part of why I really want this inflammation to go down, is to start more seriously training for that 100 miler. And that would be the Run Rabbit Run in Steamboat, Colorado in September. So that's like kind of a far off horizon, but because it's 100 miles and that really scares me, that's a very close horizon at the same time. Already kind of have the mindset of gearing up for next winter. And especially, you know, if this spring doesn't really go my way, that's okay. It just means that I've got a lot more ideas and a lot of time to plan them for next year.
Nice. So I've just started to get into trail running very deeply, but I'm curious about this 100 miler now. So do they have other distances that I could potentially run? And also, when you're training for something like that, how do you make sure that, you know, barring obviously the hip or injury, how do you make sure that what you're doing is also going to benefit you for the next ski season and you're not like totally opposite ends of the spectrum?
Yeah, totally. I think that balance is what I'm trying to figure out. And I really don't know how it's going to work out because skiing and running are definitely complementary of one another, but they are very different. And training for that much mileage is going to be a lot of miles in training. So kind of balancing that with skiing is really good for, building that endurance, but you got to get a little bit of impact training to build up to running more miles. And I also like little asterisk on all of this stuff. Like I really don't know what I'm talking about that well in the running world. It's just a passion of mine, and I definitely don't have the professional accreditations to talk to it too much. But yes, there is a 50-mile distance at the Run Rabbit Run in Steamboat that you should totally sign up for. I think it's September 13th, and you can totally stay in the Airbnb that I got the night before.
Sick. This is all working out really well.
There you go.
Yes. All right. I'm going to look it up once.
Because you're doing a 50K in August?
The beginning of August. Yeah, I'm doing a 50K. So I'm already going to be in kind of a training pattern anyways. And so that kind of actually is, I feel like, good timing because of the mileage. Yeah. And so I don't know if I said this on the goals episode, but basically I'm trying to get two trail runs that'll qualify me for like the smallest UTMB run in 2020. And so, or to qualify me for the lottery. And then, so I think actually that race might be one of them. And that would conclude my need of racing. So that's just a little tidbit about me. But I'm actually going to look that up after we get off.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
Also, this is actually, this would be my first ultra race I've ever done. The biggest thing I've done before this is a big ridge traverse here in the Wasatch. So I'm just kind of figuring out how the whole race scene works too.
Have you run a marathon?
Never in a race, just for fun training run on a trail.
Okay.
Nice.
So what's your longest distance so far?
The biggest thing I've done was that ridge traverse here in Utah. It's called Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Link Up, or the Whirl for short. And that's about, you know, it depends because it's not like a set route on a trail. You basically horseshoe Little Cottonwood Canyon. So you start at the bottom and the Salt Lake Twin Peaks are your first peak. And then you follow the ridgeline horseshoeing all the way around Little Cottonwood Canyon. And you end on Lone Peak, the other side of the canyon, the south side of the canyon, and then run out Bell's Canyon to the base of the canyon again. And so that is, you know, it kind of depends how true to the ridge you stay. I'm very proud I stayed true to the ridge. That was like 37 miles and 20,000 vert. So similar vert to what Run Rabbit Run will be, but way less mileage because it's way more like boulder hopping and scrambling than just straight up running. So a little different, but I don't know. Hopefully that helps. But again, I'm just a kook and I'm trying to figure out how to train for this whole thing.
Day.
So. Man, you could be probably hearing my voice. I'm scared the more I talk about it.
I think you'll do great. Skiers have enormous muscles in their legs, so I feel like you'll be in a good position. Awesome. I need to stop looking at my phone because I'm already looking out.
You're like literally signing up for this.
Yeah, no, I can't look at it. Well, that's rad. So that's coming up soon. And then obviously, depending what's happening with your hip, you'll have some potential PT there. So what are your kind of big goals for the rest of the year besides that? Is there anything else that we didn't touch upon?
Ooh. I'm like always scared to like mention big goals far ahead of time. You know, it's kind of like that classic like mountain athlete aesthetic. I always think of like the European trail runners who like don't say what they're doing until they've already set an FKT or something.
Right.
Right.
Definitely not like in the same category as those kind of guys.
Dude who just like on-site free soloed the Fitzroy like last week.
What? See, I'm not even a climber, so I didn't even realize that had been done.
No, he free soloed up and down.
I thought that Dean Potter did that too, twice.
No.
Well, this is a new revelation that I am having.
I'll link up the story. but yeah, so just hinging off of what you said about just like showing up and doing it, right?
Yeah.
kind of ridiculous.
That's terrifying. I don't have any goals quite like that. There's a lot of mountains I'd really like to go ski, some cool travels. I'd like to spend a lot more time here in the Wasatch and around the American West. I'd really like to, in the future, it's just a broad goal, is to combine my passions of skiing and running more.
Yeah, love that.
Dig it, man. Well, this has been like probably one of our most fun conversations. We've just been having a blast chatting and laughing with you. So thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you guys. Maybe we should have made it a video call and like wear a suit and tie to really make it that much more formal.
Next time, Emily will wear a suit with high shoulder pads and a bow tie to the Running Rabbit race.
Perfect. I'm glad that this is being pushed upon me now.
Yeah.
So we have one more question for you, Drew, and that is, what does stoke mean to you?
I knew you were going to ask this, and I was like, wow, I should come up with some profound answer. I don't think I really did. So I'm going to give you two answers.
He's okay. I'm just going to opt out of this one. Thanks, though.
First answer will be my attempt at being profound and eloquent. I would say that stoke is a full-bodied, all-consuming feeling of pure happiness, content, and satisfaction in the way that you have to share it with the world. And I think that a lot of times we'll think of stoke as like when you shout out, like when you're skiing a line, or when you just like yell with enthusiasm when you're surfing or whatever. And yes, that is a way to share it with the world, but I think too, just reaching that moment of pure happiness in the way that you share it with the world, that you smile bigger the rest of your life. I think that's stoke right there.
I like that answer.
I like that one. So that was part one answer?
That was part one.
All right. Part two,
I got to give a shout out to my buddy Zeppelin Zerup. He told me about this one. So credits to him. Also, that's the coolest name in the world.
Yeah. What was the name?
Zeppelin Zerup. He's a snowboarder and filmmaker, just an all-around good dude.
Zeppelin Zerup. All right.
Isn't that awesome?
That is a cool name.
He told me about this thing, stoke dolphins, because when you're stoked, what noise do you make? So we're all just a bunch of stoke dolphins, so welcome to the stoke pod.
Oh my God. I feel like that was made for us.
All right.
Basically.
Incredible.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Drew. This has been really fun.
And thanks for both sides of the stoke answer.
Yeah, thanks to you guys. Thanks to you for bringing me into the stoke dolphin pod that you've created here.
We're happy to have you in the pod, man.
I love it.
It's been a blast, dude. So we will, let's see, where can people, you know, get in touch and follow along? Like, what are the best places to reach out to you?
Yeah, the best way to kind of like stay connected or to reach out to me is probably Instagram. My Instagram name is Drew Peterski. And I did that just because people always spell my last name wrong. So Peterski, S-K-I. And yeah, that's probably the easiest way to reach out to me. I'm renovating my website right now, so fortunately time on the couch helps with that. But yeah, you can kind of find all the other ways to reach me right there on Insta.
Amazing. All right, well, thanks again for the time.
Thank you guys. Thanks for taking the time out of your day and for chilling out on the hill sprints for a second there, Emily.
Anything for you, Drew.
thanks, guys.
So that was our conversation with Drew Peterson. Fave, what a great guy. He was wonderful. One thing I forgot to mention in the intro is that when I did reach out to Drew, he said he was a listener of ours. And I can't tell you every time that happens, and it's somehow been happening a little bit more as we've gone on. Every time that happens with a listener, I feel like a full-on celebrity diva and that I've made it. I feel like a diva and that I've made it to the big leagues, but then I just get brought back down. But it is such a nice feeling to know that not only, I mean, there's so many people who care about the outdoors and are caring about the outdoor industry, but people that, you know, we see on Instagram or we see on these athlete teams are listening to us as well. So that always makes me feel really great. And so that was a nice little added bonus to our conversation.
Yeah, it is cool when like, you know, you might be following somebody and seeing their content or watching their films or like, you know, you use their products or whatever, and they have no idea that they are influential in your life until you have that conversation. And then it's wild when it kind of breaks that fourth wall and it's like, and they've been seeing your stuff and like you just kind of consuming it and how you have been potentially inspirational or influential in their life. It's like, it is a amazing two-way trade of influence and inspiration. And that is really, really fun when that happens.
I love a two-way trade. So, so
you're such a loser.
I'm a loser. But yeah, I think one of the things he talked about that really resonated with me was the conversation around risk. And we talk about this a lot with athletes, especially big mountain athletes, backcountry skiers, things like that, where there is a lot of risk involved. I mean, even in rock climbing and stuff, but with avalanche risk and things like that, crevasses, all kinds of stuff that I know nothing about and I'm speaking way out of turn here, but there's a lot of risk. And I liked the way he stated, like, I love skiing. I always want to ski, but I'm not going to die for the sport. And I think that's a good mindset to be in, especially like he's the youngest person on the Solomon team. And he already has this great perspective about risk and how to be conservative in the mountains when it's literally life or death. So I think that was really interesting and a great point he made.
Yeah, it is a great point. It's good to understand that. I think everybody has different risk levels and different risk tolerances and different ways to mitigate risk, right? And there's only so much you can do in wild environments like the mountains. You could be the most experienced person in the world, and you know some freak accident happens, like with Max Lowe's father back. You know, we talked to him about that situation with Alex Lowe. And Alex was like the world's top climber and just a freak avalanche, right? And same thing with actually just last week up in the White Mountains here in New Hampshire, a incredibly experienced backcountry traveler in New Hampshire set off a slide in one of the gullies off Tuckerman's Ravine on Mount Washington and unfortunately didn't survive the avalanche. So I think to a degree it's unmanageable, but you can always do your best to mitigate. I wouldn't say unmanageable, but you know, there are accidents happen that, right? But like having it in your mind going into these activities that you know, risk, injury, longevity, there's a saying, I forget if it's about skiing or climbing, that like there are bold climbers and there are old climbers, but no old bold climbers, right?
Ooh, I like that. I've never heard that. So that's a newbie for me, and I like it. Yeah.
But yeah, that's not we talk to people that are bold and that are, you know, that we hope live forever. But again, it comes down to your own risk management and your own tolerance levels and your experience. And there's a lot of factors there. But just a good conversation to have. And Drew has a good head on his shoulders about it for sure.
Faux show. The other thing you talked about, too, was just dealing with injury. And we, you know, he's young and he's had a lot of injuries already, younger than a lot of our other guests, I guess. He's not like so young, but and, you know, just dealing with that, the mental game behind it, having to listen to your body and the preventative things that, you know, we don't really necessarily talk about that too much on here, but there's a lot that you can do. Not to say Drew didn't do this, but a lot that you can do maintenance wise to keep your body in a place where it can react in the ways that it needs to when you're out doing the bigger stuff that you want to do and you're not as prone to injury, like from foam rolling, like stretching. Is the age old, like, did you stretch? You need to stretch every single day, like that kind of stuff, the little stuff. And the literally my boyfriend and I, we were like, okay, end of climbing session, we got to go do our injury prevention. That's what we call it, right? And so little things like that, we don't necessarily talk about that a lot on here because I just don't think it's come up. But you know, in dealing with these injuries, in the mental game that goes into it, it just came to mind to me as something that, you know, other people can benefit from a little bit more of. But also, obviously, there's like the unavoidable stuff that happens when you're out in the mountains. Like, if you know, foam rolling is not going to save you from like tearing your ACL or anything like that.
No, but I mean, you're right. From the thought and preparation that you bring to being preventative with accidents in the mountains, you have to bring that just, you know, to home and to training about preventing, being preventative about risk to your body, right? It is so important on that side of things. And I love one thing about this conversation, that, like, as much as I really enjoy talking high level around some of these topics and life and business and what it all means and how to pursue it and how to channel your inner drive and fulfillment and all that, I also really like getting into the nitty-gritty of just like tech and gear and the mountains. And so talking to him about his Ski the Wild West project, from just like the logistics and kind of technical mountaineering side of things, of the peaks that they were going after, to the film project, which we'll link up in the show notes here. Really great film. You should check it out. And also like talking ski tech with him and product endorsements, and totally, like, you know, he skis for Salomon, and I just happened to, that was the S-Lab boot and the shift binding that I got for my skis this year, and I love them. So I mean, I'll link that up too, but totally not aligned with Salomon here, but I love them, and so I'll say what I use because I think it's great.
Love it. Yeah, I like that a lot. I don't have skis or boots or bindings or anything. So maybe in the future I'll get some Salomon stuff.
Maybe.
Seems like it's good stuff. Well, again, I mean, thanks so much, Drew, for taking the time. And thanks so much, everyone, for listening. I think it was a great conversation. And as always, we really appreciate you guys sticking with us and staying stoked with us.
For sure. So, and also let us know if like Drew, you have a dream to see or ski the world. We want to know about it.
Yes, exactly. So you guys know where to find us, most of you. But if you don't, on Instagram, it's at the Stokecast. And then our personals are at @E_HOLLZ. That's E Halls.
E Halls?
And then Jonathan is at Jonathan Ronzio. Jonathan Ronzio.
Not
the same at all. And of course, you can find everything Stokecast related at stokecast.com. So check out all that stuff. Let us know if something resonates with you, if you're having a goal that you want to talk through, or even if you want to talk through foam rolling. You know, we could talk about that too. So just hit us up and let us know what you're thinking.
And hit up Drew too at Drew Peter Ski on Instagram. Let him know what you thought of the show and I'm sure he'd love to hear from you because
yeah,
he's just such a great, approachable, fun guy.
Yeah, and you should definitely check out his picture that he posted recently of him with a mullet and a lot of bright colors on. So
was there a burrito in the photo?
There's no burrito in the picture, which I was very disappointed with. Actually, I'm just gonna go comment that right now. Great call. All right, I'm gonna go comment that right now, so we'll check you later next week.
Yeah, Drew, what are you doing with a mullet and no burrito? Come on, you know better.
Get yourself together, Drew. Okay,
thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Emily Holland,
and I'm Jonathan Ronzio. We'll catch you next week with another episode of the Stokecast.